Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 225, Buddhism as Evolutionary Sport.
Never used the word Buddhism. There is no word Buddhism in ancient Sanskrit, absolutely not. And he never used the word. He referred to shramanas, to noble persons, to enlightened persons, to wise persons, and to arhats, to saintly persons and liberated persons, but he never used the word Buddhist. You know, he's used sometimes the word insider when someone belonged to the community that he made in his revolution. He made, you know, a community within the community. And that new community, that countercultural community, there was a word insider for someone who moved into that countercultural community. And that was the nearest thing to the word Buddhist that they have. And still in Tibet, they don't have the word Buddhist. They call it insider only because they preserve these ancient traditions. Buddhism did come in India by later when Hindus, Brahmins, were seeing it as a sort of movement later on, and they called it Bauddha. They said that's equivalent of the word Buddhist. But there was no use of that word in the ancient period at all. And there was no such word. But now but to say that Buddhism is therefore this general, all these different general things in these different contexts, doesn't deny that nowadays there are people who have a sort of set of beliefs, things that fit in the category of a religion, in our modern sense of a society where religion is the private sphere, you don't have the public sphere, and then you have your personal thing, and then your community, blah, blah. That it has like a symbol, and you have beliefs, and you have rituals, and you have like institutions. And in that context, of course, Buddhism is one of the religions, and there are many forms of it, right? There's Japanese Pure Land Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, Tibetan, different types of Theravada, different schools within that. Tibetan Buddhism itself has four major schools and other minor schools. So there are these different forms of Asian Buddhisms. That's another type of thing, and that's perfectly... That's a real element and really has to be included in a definition of Buddhism. And they perceive themselves as Buddhist as opposed to something else. You know? And then the next thing in that, which is similar to that, is the concept of Buddhism as a world religion, which is really a Western scholar's invention. And originally Buddhism was seen to be the benighted idea of the pagans. The first people who studied it were trying to figure out how to convert them and get them away. And the best ones thought of Buddhism as having prepared people for being saved by Christ. And Matteo Ricci, in fact, when he went to China, he thought he could use Buddhism was sort of preparing things. And he just grabbed a statue of Kuan Yin and ran around and said, "This is the Virgin Mary." And he got clients right away. Really? He didn't have a statue with him, so he grabbed Kuan Yin and said, "Here's the Virgin Mary." And then they came in, you know. And then they were praying to Kuan Yin, and he said, "I've converted some Christians." He was very happy. And in general, Buddhism was studied only as how to free people from its benighted influence, you see. This miserable, pessimistic, etc. I mean, I don't want to go into it, but it's quite a thing. But then when they kind of a little bit got to New Window earlier, and this really only since World War II, really, in this century, the concept of world religion arose against great resistance, because otherwise, you know, there was only religion, you know. The religion, which was the one religion, you know, the one true religion. But after World War II, you know, imperialism sort of went out of fashion. The white man's burden kind of got a little too heavy. The British had to leave India. You know, we all know the story. And then they got into the concept of a world religion, which in a way reflects the idea that there could be more than one, and therefore was a bitter pill to swallow. But there are, and for some still haven't quite swallowed it, actually, quite a few. But they're working at it. CIS is way beyond that, but there are real places where it's a real problem. I have the colleagues in academia who come from a certain background, you know, they're in Asian area. A lot of people in Asian studies in particular come from missionary families, so either their parent or grandparent lived in that society, or maybe if they're older, they lived in that they grew up as children in a mission somewhere. And I've had them look at me, you know. And we're colleagues and friends, and then suddenly they'll look at me. And you see the fires of hell flickering in their eyes. And you know that's where you're headed, you know. And they look sad because you're an apostate, you know. And you were born a Protestant, and what could have happened to you? Poor fellow. And they look really like it's a problem, you know. They really do. And you almost feel a little nervous, at least you do if you're younger. So world religion is a step forward, but that is a Western invention, the idea of a world religion, you know. Because Buddhism has, and then everyone's kind of puzzled when they put Buddhism as one, because, you know, the head of the Vietnamese thing, there is no head of the Vietnamese church, quote unquote, and then this one doesn't listen to that one, and the, you know, even this Lama doesn't listen to the Dalai Lama. I mean, they don't have this kind of structure organization like a religion as we think of it does. You know? It's very much still an individual thing. Now we come to the Western appropriations, Buddhism as a contemplative discipline. And this is, of course, a big one around here and in the world. And this is an invention of Euro-Americans, driven nearly crazy by anxiety because of the desperation induced by the cumulative violence of our heritage and the tremendous gloom and pessimism it normally induces. I'm sorry, I did type that out. So, since our minds are so agitated and anxious and we're so full of worry, even though we have this material, even exacerbated by the fact of our material relative luxury, in that we don't have to go and bring water a mile and a half from a well, and therefore all we can do with all that energy is worry about the plumbing. And so contemplation becomes a big thing for us, and therefore, naturally, the Buddhists have great methodology and fantastic psychology of altered states and great methodology of contemplation. And so we think, oh, that's what Buddhism is, it's meditation. And we rush off, and we have meditation centers and meditation seminars and meditation weekends, and we think that's what Buddhism is. Even people think Buddhist psychology is meditation. But that is really not quite correct. But anyway, it is, however, part of it, and it's something that we've learned from Buddhism, as well as from Hinduism and yoga and other things, but mainly from Buddhism in late recent decades. And so that's another vision of Buddhism as mainly meditation, which has to be balanced by, of course, the fact that, and is becoming, it is actually now in the 80s and 90s, it is more becoming balanced by an awareness of that Buddhism is constituted by what is called the three educations. And the three educations are three spiritual educations, the Adishiksha. And the three spiritual educations are the spiritual educations of injustice or ethics, the spiritual education in mind or psyche, or sometimes in meditation, or sometimes in psychology. It's used two different words. You can use citta, or you can use the word samadhi. So either mind or meditation, you can use either word. And then the third spiritual education is the spiritual education in wisdom. And the word which we translate wisdom, perhaps not rightly, is prajna. And the word prajna is really more means intelligence than wisdom, actually, which is a little disappointing, I know, because we think of wisdom as some sort of intuitive hunch-like thing, you know. I got a hunch that it'll rain, and a hunch that, you know, this won't work, and hunch. And whereas prajna is like a direct knowledge of the nature of the subatomic energies, where you actually see them yourself. I mean, it's like incredibly acute. It's like you are a CAT scan machine. You know by prajna exactly what another person is thinking. You know which fluids and which wetware things are gurgling and which synapse has like the distorted notion of what. Ultimately, I mean, not everyone, but full-blown prajna is like a knowing of everything really by being with everything in a certain way, like CAT scanning the universe, if you can imagine that. It's hard to imagine, but that is what prajna really means. So therefore, and prajna at the simplest level in Buddhist language means intelligence. And every being has prajna in there as one of the what are called ubiquitous mental factors in their psyche, in their makeup. They have some intelligence. And jnya, you know, prajna. Jnya is like the same Indo-European, kno, you know. Kno to kno, you know. K-N-O, you know. It's this thing you do with your nasal passages, you know. You kno whatever it is, you know. So jnya is just knowing, you know. And then pra is like super. So it's like super knowing. So, you know, wisdom is a little tame, you know, a little like. And the symbol of wisdom in Mahayana Buddhism, anyway, is this 16-year-old dude, you know, who's orange-colored skin, whole body is orange colored with flames coming, holding a sword with flames in the tip and a book of the Prajnaparamita, of perfect wisdom, in the other hand. Not an old sort of gray kind of like beaten down wisdom. No, the groundhog man, you know. Okay. So now, finally we come to Buddhism as an evolutionary sport. What I call Buddhism as an evolutionary sport. Which is what I would like it to be, you know, obviously. And what do I mean by an evolutionary sport? Even beyond a way of life and death. And evolutionary sport, it means that... what does it mean? A way of death and life, which provides a methodology for making the process of evolution conscious, purposeful, and a sport in the sense of being playful and enjoyable rather than a job in the sense of compulsive and barely tolerable, which is how I would wish we could approach it. And by that I mean that Buddha's own vision of the world came to be that there is no beginning to the world and that all of our lives have been beginningless, right? There's no Big Bang, or no definitive Big Bangs. They're little poops, you know, but no Big Bang. And there were things before the Big Bang, and we existed before the Big Bang in other universes, and next Big Bang will be another universe. You know, in other words, there's no limit to life. This was the basic vision. The real vision of the Buddha was relationality infinite. Not some sort of running away out of the world into some icebox defined nirvana, and not some sort of, big, like, cold, gloomy, like, disappearing act, but infinite relationality. And infinite relationality means that there's been no beginning. We've always been alive in different forms. Death is like nothing. It's not there. It's just a transition. It's like when someone goes through a door, then they're out of this room. You don't see them anymore. But they're in the next one, completely next room, just instantaneously. There's no staying in the doorway. You know, there's no, the doorway is just an arbitrary line. You know, they're either parts are inside and parts are outside. There's no width to a line, right? No width to a line. There's no duration to death. It's just an instant transition. When the spiritual, subtle part of us splits from the material, gross part and heads, because it's become like unworkable usually, and gets a better new material thing to run around in, you know. It's, I call it the cheapest rejuvenation technique in history. Don't you think? In other words, you have this creaky old thing, it hurts, it's like full. And you get a nice new one. Yeah, I guess someone fusses with you for 10 years and feeds you and fondles you. It's very cool. Much better than some nursing home and wired together. So, I mean, if you're a reborn human, which you try to be. And so it's beginningless and it's endless. And it's even endless for the enlightened, was Buddha's view. There's no end. Nirvana is not the end of life, it is the end of suffering. Nirvana is boundless life, boundless bliss. And so that was his basic vision, right? So if they given that vision then he thought, well, now I am really, I mean, he didn't even think, he felt really happy. He felt like he had reached the most meaningful position, the most meaningful state that you could possibly reach. He understood all of his own previous evolution. He remembered all of his previous existences. And actually, they were immediate to him, not like way somewhere in some linear notion of a past. And he could see all kind of future interactions because of the future. He had, in a way, no demand for a future personally because he was absolutely culminated in happiness. But he saw that others would have much future. And he saw that they were him and interconnected with him. And he wanted to help them that their future should be as little of it suffering and as much of it bliss as possible. Right? So in that vision then, he noted he had come to that as a human. And by remembering the past, he realized that the human is the best vehicle to gain this kind of freedom. Biological, evolutionary, intellectual, emotional freedom. And really find bliss. Human, that's what the human, you know they go around saying, oh, gee, we don't know what the brain is for. Have you ever heard these guys, the neurons? We're chasing down those neurons that have faces on them and the ones that have letters, and they're on the left and the right. And where are they? And then argue, and another $1 billion research. Okay, slice a few more monkeys with that faucet slicer, you know? And they're chasing the brain, and then they, we don't need all this brain. We can, like, run around and drive cars. We don't, what's this huge bunch of slimeware there? What is it doing there? We don't need it. All these ripples and crinkles and wrinkles. And I can't even research it all before I croak. And what is it doing there? You know, they were freaking out. Well, Buddha could have told. Buddha knew what it was for. Buddha knew what the brain was for. The brain is there to feel bliss, to feel pleasure. It like lights up like a Christmas tree if it really gets the energy in it. If its clamps go off it, if you're not scared of being trampled by some kind of, like, you know, policeman or a priest or father or somebody, and you're just relaxing, and the brain is a tremendous tool for bliss. That slimeware can really have some appreciation of stuff. All those amazing connections, enjoying like what a flower is, and writing a poem, you know. The brain is like really there for creativity. The brain is there because it is adequate, Buddha realized, to understand the nature of everything, the self and the universe. And that understanding is what brings bliss. And that bliss is not losable, because once one has this vehicle and gains that understanding, then that understanding transcends being located in a particular hardware, so to speak. It's like a kind of software that can go out on the internet. It's like a program that can meander here and there. You know? It could actually be playing on 50 different receptors at once. It has no limitations in that way. It's apparently an amazing form of life. And the brain is like the doorway to that. Because the mind in the brain then can unramify its sensitivity to connectedness infinitely. He realized. So then naturally when you realize that, what do you realize? Every single human being is infinitely precious. Every single human being's life, they made themselves primarily. Yes, the parents lent a gene or two. The country let them have some food and didn't slaughter them on sight. The different people have contributed, but the planet is the right distance from the sun in this particular way, etc. All kinds of circumstances, but mainly they got to that life from this view, from many previous experiments in other life forms. Every one of us was some kind of grisly dinosaur. Every one of us was a horned demon. Every one of us was a god slobbering around in a hot tub. And we got bored with that, and we got realized how unsatisfying it was to be mean and nasty, and we got tired of eating crocodile food, you know, clamping those jaws, how boring, you know. Insensitive skin, crocodile caress, what would it be? Crocodile kiss, we have crocodile tears, but kiss? Forget it. So he saw each human being as this precious legacy of their own karmic or evolutionary effort, through billions and billions and billions of lifetimes. And he said, and some of my colleagues, my parents, my father even, he would happily order 10,000 of these precious, incredible vehicles of potential enlightenment and bliss into battle, to over some pond or some county or some road and some temple or something, and killing other people and getting killed. Instead of, and then maybe regressing to become, because they were wearing armor, you know, they were clank, 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 be reborn as a beetle or something. They were like hoping their armor was strong enough to withstand the enemy's attack. Tank pilot, you know, reborn a B-52 pilot as a dragonfly. Because he liked the form. You know, nobody awards those forms, but people get deluded into liking those forms and they head towards them. In the state of, you know, when they get to the sort of like karmic lottery after death. So he saw that, so he said, maximize the time in every society that these precious beings, with these precious hearts, and these precious brains, and this precious evolutionary history, to reach a stage where they cannot lose this status, and they at least will be reborn in an equally great, you know, better and better human embodiment, if they can't actually become liberated, even in this life. You see how he would be naturally grabbed by that view? You see? And in a Buddhist way of life country, such as Tibet and Mongolia were, then that's why they don't want to have a road system. They don't want to have an army. They don't want to produce widgets.
they want, if they have a wheel, you know, the stupid British say, oh, the Tibetans don't have a wheel. Then, you know, every Tibetan's there going, oh, Mani Padme Hum, with a prayer wheel. Well, they didn't invent a wheel because they didn't have a road system with carts so they could busily haul widgets back and forth, which is what the dumb Anglos spend their time doing. When you die, if you've had a lifetime of widget hauling, and you're like dying, your unconscious is completely unknown to you, and your hostilities and your addictions are all bubbling and seething and frothing, you know, and you're having 11 horror movies and 3 or 4 like erotic movies and 7 other movies all going on, which one shall I go? And you've idealized the form of a whale or of a baboon or whatever, and you never know where you're going to end up. The fact that you were the world tycoon of widgets is going to mean anything to you? So that's what evolutionary sport is. You want to have your time free for to play around so as to improve your evolutionary progress, you see. And what Buddhism should be, could be, will more be in this planet, let us pray, hope, will be more and more people getting more time to do that. And like less and less of the widget all, you know. Okay, so that's enough. So questions, though. We have more time. And there should be some questions. That's all I have to say tonight. So what questions? Oh no, that's terrible. Yes, sir. I don't think it has that great an appeal. We all go on and on about materialism, but I don't think it's such a huge appeal. Actually, in a conversation, I had this insight once, actually here in this building, in a conversation with Brian Swim, that the attraction of matter, or the need of matter, from a Buddhist point of view, could be seen to be that matter is embedding awareness in matter is a slightly scary thing to do, but to be embedded in matter is very essential to be embodied in order to be able to discover other beings. A mental being will gravitate into a samadhi area like that, all isolated, you know, nothing, calm, quiet, you know, zone out and zonk out and waste eons just being self-centered, really, without even knowing it because they've sort of blocked out the idea there is anybody else. And so, but when you have a body, you know, there's all, you know, like a mammal, you know. Imagine a mammal, you have to like start out inside another mammal. If you're a female mammal, you have to now and then have another one of those characters inside there. You know, later when they get big, they bother you when they come home from the bar. But at that time, you've got to have them inside and they're kicking and like making you have heartburn and making you want to eat something you don't really like that much. Gobbling up some kind of crab meat or something in case they're the rebirth of some Samoan, you know. And meanwhile, you don't like fish. And, So being in matter, being connected in matter is like a whole way of being interconnected and beginning to discover other beings. And therefore, you know, to lure beings into embodiment, you know, this is always the great challenge to me is in the teaching of Vimalakirti, the holy teaching of Vimalakirti, the sutra that I began to study years ago when I translated it, as my teacher said to me at the time, oh, see, you're beginning to study that, he said when I handed him the translation. And at the time, I said, what do you mean, I translated it? But then he was right, I was beginning, and I still don't understand it. But the thing about the Vimalakirti is it always talks about how this is a Buddha land that we're in. That this land is Shakyamuni's Buddha land. It's called, and the name of it as a Buddha land is not America or planet Earth or anything. The name of it is Saha. The Sanskrit word Saha. And that means barely tolerable. That's the name of it. This is the planet called Tolerable. You know, barely tolerable. Because why is tolerable? Because it's like, and the argument in the Vimalakirti is that this is one of the greatest Buddha machines in transgalactic, transuniversal history.
because this one is sort of maintained. It wasn't created, because Buddha doesn't create them. We created ourselves. But Buddha and Bodhisattvas lured us here, because this one is sort of maintained at a sort of average temperature of misery versus release from misery, in such a way that we're sort of always on an edge, and we can be, there are others around who we can feel compassion for, and we can become objects of compassion for others, because we are usually hung up and miserable too. And like, it's a place where, while wisdom it takes effort to, and intelligence takes effort to cultivate, compassion has plenty of supply to deal with, you know. Much better than a heavenly Buddha land where you just sit under an incense tree and sniff and have another 10,000 samadhis. But your compassion withers because there's no, the homeless people are so far away. You know. So on that one level, matter, material, even of the body, the material of which is the start of materialism, being the body itself, is something that actually we're encouraged and lured to, you know. And then material objects, of course, are becoming extensions of the body, become simply ways of distracting ourselves from this inner problem. You see, I don't know still, I haven't personally experienced it, but tiny little hints I've had, dreams and things, you know, because about the fact that, you know, if you have an injury or something, if you have like a bullet in your leg or something, you have something that is like a constant pain, your system is so marvelous that it sort of isolates it and then ignores it in a certain way, you know, and then you can go along and you actually forget that you're in that pain, you know? And the egocentric person, the misknowledge driven person, has a knot around their heart that is like constricting the center of their being, of our being. It's like squeezing inside, you know. And so because of that, we think that we're like someone who's writhing, and we're grabbing for this or that, and we want to pay attention to some soft texture on our hand because we have a pain in our chest, you see. But it doesn't really distract, you see. So, but then if we get 10 things to stroke, if we get a hand machine that like constantly flaps our hand, we'll get away from this pain, you see. So I think the attraction of material, or even a lot of materialism, is just conceptual. I was talking to a guy today who knows a little bit about it, and he was saying that a lot of these people who have like hundreds of millions of dollars, they don't really know what is a dollar even anymore. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. But then they will go nuts to get like 500 million. If they have five, to get a billion. It's just a number. It's a concept, actually. It's conceptualism that they're caught in. Because they want to be more of a billionaire than the other. They have no one can spend $1 billion dollar by dollar. You have to live a thousand years to do it. And so I don't think, in a way, real materialism would be actually preferable to the way that people get stuck in ideas, you know. You know, the fact that the mind can be hung up in distorted ideas so vastly, I think, actually. And I think even if we knew how to pay attention more to objects, and people who like take care of flowers, you could say that's materialistic, but I don't think so. I think that that's a way they're getting a little bit, if they can learn something from taking care of a flower, you know. But then if it's the idea that I own that flower, I'm going to compete and be the greatest flower owner, I'm going to have a million flowers. That's mental. That isn't really materialist, that's mental. I mean, we call it materialistic because it leads them to be greedy and stupid, but in a way it's mental. It isn't even proper materialism, you know. This is something that, again, that Western people do miss. From a lifetime of sort of teaching and discussing about Buddhism, say, you know, that whole set of concepts I didn't go to about how Buddhism is this pessimistic thing, and only Asiatics could have gotten into that, you know. Because, you know, they have a much more miserable life than we do in Europe. That we Europeans, we enjoy life, you know, we have Christmas and shit. And, you know, and meanwhile, they have, like, Christmas three times a month, you know. And you know, the four aims of life in India, one of them is karma, you know. They had the sex manuals way back there, you know. The Kama Sutra, it's like Masters and Johnson's previous incarnation. Masters and Johnson would have been burned at the stake in Europe up until very recently. You know, and even today, I don't know what the nudester would do to them. And Indians had this sort of sensual and sensory thing, and you know, in other words, that is not necessarily so evil and so bad. You know? And also, secondly, another big thing is that in history, in all the different countries where Buddhism has thrived, even as a countercultural thing, the major force, the major class that supported Buddhism in those places was the merchant class. Because business people like peace, intelligent ones, you know, who want to have long-term profitability. You know, pirates like war, you know, and fanatic priests don't mind a little religious war, you know. But business people know that war is ultimately bad for business because it sort of wipes out your customers. You know? And so Buddhism was always supported by merchants everywhere. And actually, that's why Buddhism had a real hard time in China, because in China, the mercantile class was always controlled by the dictatorship of the bureaucracy too much, and they didn't allow so much free mercantilism as they did in India, and because it was not as wealthy a country ever, you know. And so Buddhism and business have an old, long, and honorable history, and dishonorable, I'm sure, in the middle too, here and there. So materialism is really not the enemy. Greed is, of course, the enemy, but often greed is much more invested in ideas and images and things than it is in actual objects.
Aloha, greetings, and salutations, dear podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded during Professor Thurman's 1996 trip to the California Institute of Integral Studies. To learn more about this four-part Visiting Scholars series, please look in the podcast description. Links will be provided to the California Institute of Integral Studies website, where extended versions of these talks can be found. Special thanks to CIIS for making these talks available through the Creative Commons licensing. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special VIP invites to special events like the annual benefit concert at Carnegie Hall, curated by Tibet House co-founder and vice president Philip Glass, please visit the Tibet House US website at tibethouse.us. You can help make a difference with your monthly membership donations. Help Tibet House present and preserve Tibetan culture in New York City at Tibet House US and in the Catskill Mountains at Menlo Retreat and Dewa Spa. Music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is generously supplied by our dear friend Tenzing Chogyal. Use the artist's permission, all rights reserved. To learn more about the music and work of Tenzing Chogyal, please visit his website at tenzingchogyal.com. And now, back to the second half of this week's episode, which concludes with some poetry read by Gary Gock. Thanks for tuning in.
So a lot of great masters went up into the hills. That's the natural thing you would do. You would go up the Himalayan river valleys up into the Himalaya, then you'd maybe go across the Himalaya. Then some Tibetans would find you, and then they'd come up and say, well, what can we do, you know? And these people were, some of the people who went up there were these incredible individuals. what are called the Siddhas, or the great adepts, you know, the Vajrayana men and women. And these were kind of, you know, they were all like St. Patrick, right? St. Patrick went to Ireland and he chased all the snakes out, right? He had like magical power. He got rid of all the snakes. There are no snakes in Ireland, right? No, there are none. I know that. I heard that. He really did. He chased them out. They all went over to England. And it's true. There are no snakes in Ireland. And Patrick chased them out. And so there was this kind of people like St. Patrick, you know. They were just intense people. They would meet kings, and the kings would, you know, the king's courtiers would come up and say, bow down to the king and stuff. And he would say, I don't bow down to kings. No. And then they would draw their swords, and then like fire would flash out of his face, and they would all like grumble. No, really, they were really amazing. They were sort of miracle-type people. I mean, we have these stories, and of course, modern religion scholars say this is hagiographic, which makes them feel better, a lot better, that, you know, it couldn't have happened. But at least the people then thought it happened. So whether real fire came out or whether it was something about the personal presence that was like real fire, the kings certainly like paid attention to them and didn't kill them, in fact, which is always to me a miracle, you know. Because Caesar's always killing everybody who comes and says, do be nice, you know, then they kill them. I say, well, you can be nice, and I'm Caesar, and so you're dead, you know. No, that's the usual thing. So somehow, in Tibet, those kings were just the same kind of people like that, but they couldn't do it to these people. And, you know, the Siddhas were constantly provoking different kings to kill them, actually, and then they would be there the next day. Like the story of Naropa, you all know this great story of Naropa, the great Siddha in India. He enraged the king because he was running around nude with his girlfriend in downtown Benares. And they were, actually, it's kind of worrisome, they were sort of stuck together, I hate to say. Like, can happen, you know, when you mate the dogs. But somehow they were athletically, she was clinging around him, and then he also happened to have behind her back somehow a bow and arrow, and he was running around hunting the protected deer in the king's park and barbecuing them. All the while in this rather awkward position. And so this infuriated the citizens of Benares. I swear this is a real hagiographic story. It shows you India is a different kind of place, you know. And this is long before the beatniks, at least 1,300 years before them. Or Walt Whitman, for that matter, you know. And so they said that this is ridiculous, and these people must be demons, and it's terrible, and the deer and everything. And they didn't even notice that after he had gobbled down this deer, he and his beloved, that when they came and said, how can you be a religious person and be eating that deer like that? You know, and he would say, what deer? And snapped his fingers, and the greasy bones jumped up and refleshed themselves, and the deer gambled off across the lawn. So, I mean that's the hagiography, right? So then they took him and his girlfriend, and they put him in a nice corrective institution, which was namely a giant funeral pyre. And then they lit it. And then they walked home happily. We got rid of those two deviants. And there was a huge blaze on the horizon, you know, in this park, you know. But then, unfortunately, inconveniently, they came back the next morning, and they were still there and still at it. And where the fire had been was like a giant lotus pond with, like, lakes and jeweled ducks going quack, quack, quack. And, like, it was, like, incredible. Then they left him alone after that. He could do what he liked, so to speak, after that, you know. He had his poet's license after that. Now, this is the type of people hagiographically. Now, I'm not saying it happened, it didn't. It's a hagiography. It's some respected sort of magical story of how people's negative presuppositions are stripped away that you have in ancient India and Tibet. But these are the type of people who went to Tibet, is what I'm saying. They were really this type of people. They were people who, and I've seen these things in Tibet, they were people who took their hand and just pressed it into a rock just to sort of leave behind a little trace, just to sort of show something. You know, I always used to think that was crazy, and that some religious guy who wanted to make money was out there chipping away with his chisel, you know, a little fingerprint in there, like, and then they get the tourists to come, you know, chip, chip, chip. And, you know, but only recently in traveling in Tibet have I come to see somehow, maybe there is a state. I mean, my mind is open to it. If I saw it, I'd probably, like, freak out like Carlos Castaneda's always doing. I'd probably vomit on the floor and have a fit. But the idea that, you know, rocks are alive, too. You know, rocks are energy, that there are atoms swirling around. It's not really that hard in some way. If you are understanding atom to atom, you know, strong force to strong force, maybe you could, but you wouldn't waste your time going around kneading rocks, you know. But now and then you just want to show people who are stuck in a rock-filled world that rocks are also part of life, and that you can just put a handprint in the rock, and the rock will respond. The rock is sensitive, and the rock is, and they can remember you by that print. You know? And you do see them in Tibet, and they really don't look like somebody did it with a chisel. So anyway, this was the sort of people. And by this kind of effort, over about 1,000, I dated as 1,000-year period, from 640, when Buddhism entered Tibet as a countercultural thing, as elsewhere in the rest of Asia, to 1640, when the fifth Dalai Lama became the ruler of Tibet, and when Tibet was sort of formally demilitarized. Extraordinary thing happened in a very warlike country's history, where the nobles came not just to have a Magna Carta, but they came and they decided that none of their own layman ilk was fit to rule the others, and they would continue to have strife and fight and kill, and that, of course, a couple who were pretty wanted to rule themselves had to be convinced of this by a couple of Mongolian armies, but that's another part of the story. But anyway, after that convincing, then they all agreed they didn't want to have another lay person with an army rule them. And they even didn't want to have the military style of life. And so they appointed their head lama, so to speak, who they perceived as the reincarnation of the messianic Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. And they appointed him as their ruler, and they disbanded all their armies. And then the Mongolian warlord who had helped, you know, smooth out the last edges of this transition was asked to, and did, withdraw back to Mongolia. So the country became demilitarized. 300 years approximately before Costa Rica demilitarized, which is the only demilitarized country on our benighted planet. That when Solanas was in Costa Rica and praising them for being demilitarized, and the way he did it was he said that he decided that he really was encouraged that they had been, by that time, 40, almost 50 years demilitarized when he visited there sometime a few years ago. And he said that one of the effects he detected there was that they had no mosquitoes. He said, "You have less mosquitoes, and the ones you do have are nicer," he said. And I embarrassed him a little bit by saying, "Well, it is nice that they demilitarized, Your Holiness. It is true," in front of President Arias and another one. And I said, "But actually, you should tell President Arias that you demilitarized, your predecessor did 500 years ago. Or no, 300 years ago." And he's kind of looked like, "Let's not be like," I embarrassed him, you know. But the fifth Dalai Lama did, you know. And then it became a Buddhist, then it became what I call a way of life Buddhist country, in the sense that the main institution of the country was the monastic educational institution. And the highest percentage of the population ever in Buddhist history or history of any country went into being monasteries. And just to give you an idea of that, in the recent period where we have a count of monasteries by how many the Chinese destroyed, it's over 6,000 monasteries in the land of Tibet. There were major, and some of these monasteries had 10,000 monks, not your 22 monks that you have, you know, on the 300 acres, you know, making the jam and jelly that we find in our Protestant, on the Protestant country, you know, where you basically don't like monks because they don't do anything useful. You know? No, we don't. That's the way we are, you know. And they're not productive, you know. And but these are monasteries that are cities, thousands and thousands of monks and hundreds and thousands of nuns. And you have hundreds of thousands of people doing that. Very good, by the way, population balancing method, by the way. But anyway, you compare that figure for a population of about 6 to 8 million people. And in Europe, during the height of this Cistercian monastic flowering in the 13th century, there were only 1,600 monasteries in all of Europe. And most of them much smaller than that. In Russia, in all the Russias, when the communists destroyed in 1917, there were only 800 Orthodox monasteries in the entire of all of the Russias. And yet, when the Tibetans were destroyed with that small population and that rather sparse economy, over 6,000 monasteries. And because no army, basically. Imagine CIS has trouble fundraising, right? Which is very unjust and wrong. Even Colombia has trouble fundraising. Actually, Harvard thinks they have trouble, but that's kind of hard to imagine with the many billions that they have. But in general, all the schools have trouble fundraising, right? Because there's this $300 billion Pentagon budget. Imagine if the $300 billion of the Pentagon was spent entirely on education. What sort of country would we have? Right? Presidente could relax. Right? It would be just no problem, you know. People would have realized priority. You know? What is the priority in life? Going around and killing people? No. Training people to do it? No. Priority in life is each person bringing out their greatest thing, having their greatest moment, and actually, from the Buddhist point of view, making it last for infinite future lives, such a great moment, and sharing it with infinite numbers of other beings. That's the priority of life, isn't it? So why not spend the money on the priority? Imagine, my students always look shocked at you know, an ordinary undergraduate. My persona is slightly different, but not much, a little bit. But, you know, I try to be a little more like conventional. But still, they do get shocked with me when I urge them not to rush, spend a couple of extra years in college. Stay, you know, 4 years, six years. Hang out, be a triple major. If your parents can afford it, just like, don't worry about it, don't rush. You're rushing to graduate and go out and do something. You know? But then you're at the best time of your life now. Because you, for the moment, people are not necessarily expecting you. Grudgingly, they're giving you a couple of years to sort of do something for yourself and be something more yourself. Right? And of course, the only doing is they think then you'll do more things later. But never mind that point. Just sort of delay. And actually realize that the whole purpose of your life is now you're in face of it. Not that you're finding it here and you're going to go off and do it. Now is you're in front of the purpose of your life. Purpose of your life is to learn more. Is to become a new kind of being. They just look in shock. They're like, what? I don't have to go to medical school right away? You don't want to go to medical school until you genuinely care about healing other people. Enlightenment should be a diploma criterion. We shouldn't let them out. Really? How can you let all these people out to go and become lawyers and this and that and go out and like become crooked politicians and all this stuff unless they were enlightened? You shouldn't. No. Yes, you passed the test, but you're still a selfish bastard. You're a male chauvinist pig. Your great-grandfather's like nasty chauvinist habit patterns, you can still see it, the way you flick your cigarette. Forget it. Go over there to the Marshall Zendo. Go over there to the yoga center. Like, no way are you getting out of here. You can leave, but no diploma. Hey, wouldn't that be great? Imagine if we had a school like that. Woo! They would really sweat. As a frustrated professor for many years, it really fills me with joy, the prospect, I can tell you. So, you know, they tell them, they say, you know, like at Amherst College, which prides itself on being so incredibly enlightened, you know, and into like liberal this, because it's a very elite, you know. You hear when they get there, they have this speech on not just intellectual this, you know, decency and sensibility, you know, that means like one class in art history and one class in the religion or philosophy department. And then when they graduate, they get a little couple of words dropped like that. And that's it. Except from individuals who, like, you know, a little bit deviant like me, who give them a hard time, you know. A few of them, only a few, that, you know, a few of them who are dissatisfied with whatever the other delights are and who happen to find you in that department, right? This is one of my students, right? Right? Very few. You were few, right? You were few. So then the next thing, so way of life. So then the Buddha, then the Tibetans proved what an amazing thing this was for them from the 17th century in that, and I'll come back to this later, in this way of life thing of turning a whole nation into this type of thing. They proved it by actually sharing that with the Mongolians, one of the roughest people around, you know, historically, you know, not at all the yogis and this and that, but to really ferocious fighters and strong individual people, credible people, but very, very violent, into the violence game in a big way. The largest actual physical empire ever conquered by anybody in the history of the world, including the British or anybody, was by the Mongolians, without technology, without motor cars and airplanes. And yet, within a couple of hundred years, they were like sitting around, demilitarized, meditating, trying to be selfless, learning the deep thought of philosophy of selflessness, and putting themselves into it, you know, conquering themselves, turning that warrior energy into the conquest of the self. Amazing event, really, that Tibetan transformation of the Mongolians. And then, of course, our century naturally has then made it like look bad because they've been chewed up. They're that vulnerability, even their isolation, the vulnerability of the Russians and the Chinese, you know, and the British originally came in and squeezed them, destroyed them lately. They're in this state of near destruction.
Welcome to the Bob Thurman Podcast. I'm Gary Gock. Juan Felipe Herrera. Juan Felipe was born in Fowler in 1948. He's a poet, performer, writer, cartoonist, teacher, and activist, and author of several books. His most recent being Notes from the Assemblage from City Lights. Note, he was a poet laureate of these states from 2015 to 2017. His latest book begins. It can begin with clouds, how they fray, how they enter, then how they envelop the earth in a second or two. They vanish. You touch them. They take you. You find yourself in their absence. Sometimes you read them somehow. The separation, the losses, the sky. Yes, it is the sky they were talking about. The character for sky. You are there now. You have always been there now. Where there is fire and thunder face behind the torn universe, you can see this, how it shreds itself, so you can see this. That is all there is, then nothing again, then you again, and the clouds come to you, and you pass. I'm Gary Gock, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast, and is published by Tibet House US, Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa, under a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal.